Marion Hart glanced up from the thick old textbook, distracted by voices beyond the window of the Sigmund Samuel Library. An hour before, she'd noticed four or five students hanging around out there, wrapped in a rainbow of ponchos and patched jean jackets, accessorized by sunglasses, cigarettes, and signs. Now there were about a dozen of them, and their volume had risen with their numbers. She rubbed her burning eyes, worn out by tiny print, then set her pen aside. Leaning back in her chair, she scanned the familiar placards outside. Dotted by peace signs, hearts, and flowers, their slogan demanded, "End the war! Get out of Vietnam! Canada wants peace!" She spotted a large love sign, painted in luminous orange, outlined in red, and framed by a scattering of cheery daisies. A young man, his crown of brown curls only partially restrained by a bright yellow headband, had taken control with a bullhorn. He was bellowing something Marion couldn't make out, but the crowd evidently heard. They raised their arms and cheered joyfully in response. The 1960s were all about change, and that was even more noticeable this year. For someone like Marion, quietly studying within the walls of the university, there was so much to observe. All over the world, eager young fists grasped at fresh ideas and opportunities while shaking with disapproval at the man. "All will be solved," those young people swore, "through peace, harmony, and free love." If only they didn't have to make a living. Marion was quietly envious of the kids outside her window and their enthusiastic approach to the world. Throughout her youth, including the past few years she'd studied at the University of Toronto Medical School, she had not once stood up to the status quo, though her presence there had challenged it. She had accepted early in her education that, as a woman, her questions and arguments would rarely be addressed by her male professors or fellow students. As a result, she had spent most of her time with her head in books, shutting out the rest of the class. What mattered was attaining her degree and becoming a practicing physician, not drawing attention to herself, and certainly not pointing out the shortcomings of her colleagues. It wasn't until fourth year, when Dr. Reginald Perkins came to teach medical ethics and economics, that she dared to lift her gaze from the page. Marion had been awestruck by Dr. Perkins's eye-opening approach to medicine. He taught the practical topics, like medical economics and the pitfalls of running a practice. But he also led them beyond the textbooks, discussing the bond of a physician to his patients, other doctors, and society as a whole. One of her favorite lectures addressed how doctors should communicate with patients during difficult times, such as discussing a terminal diagnosis. At present, a woman received news of her own condition and prognosis secondhand, after her husband had been told. Dr. Perkins had startled the class by suggesting that approach should change. Either the woman should learn about her own illness first, he said, or the couple should be told at the same time. That had roused quite a discussion. They also deliberated over contentious issues like organ transplants, birth control, abortion, and euthanasia. The lessons were vital, she believed, because society was undergoing massive shifts and the healthcare system had to as well. She was disappointed that Dr. Perkins's 4 one-hour sessions were recommended, but not mandatory, and that they weren't graded. They deserved more weight than that. Marion graduated with a degree in medicine in 1965, one of a handful of female doctors in a class that was 90% men. After graduation, she earned a position at the Ontario Hospital, formerly the Hospital for the Insane, becoming the only woman doctor in the building. She was proud of that accomplishment, but without female classmates, she got a little lonely sometimes.